Entities is a topic. I don't believe in entities. I do believe in entities. Does anybody believe in entities? What is an entity? Entity is an identity with something lacking. The id entity is one of the terms that I often use to understand the relationship between parts of the mind. So in that sense, the story of entities and identities and it entities connected to the ego is also connected to the mind. So when we talk about entities, as I interpret it, it is part of the mind, and specifically dealing with fragments of the mind which are trying to connect to other understanding, specifically trying to connect to these things we do not understand. And so for many centuries, many eons already, there are all kind of stories that people tell each other about entities and identities and the relationship between them. So at the moment that you can connect to it, it is an identity, and at the moment that you can not connect to it, it is an entity. But essentially it's just the same. It's the difference lies in the connectedness. And of course, if you try to connect to something you do not understand as yet, then you run into this whole paradigm of science where you need to get to know the unknown. And once you sort of get in touch with the unknown, you have no notion what it is. You in a way need to conceive of some kind of idea that you can get a grasp of it. And then once you turn it into an idea, you can sort of operate it, but you cannot really connect the two things until you can turn it into a thought. And at that moment, you have the notion that it has become tangible in your mind. It physically, of course, it never becomes tangible because we are dealing with a world of ideas. As I described in the story of mind, there's these stages between the notions, the concept, the idea, and the thought. And they are, in a way, the alchemy of going from the fire to the air to the water to the earth element. You could also say that it goes from the steam to the vapor to the water to the ice. It is a process of condensation. In this case, it is a condensation of information. What we are dealing with, the difference between entities and identities, is that it is tangible, yes or no. Over the years and over the cultures, there are many attempts to understand the intangible. There were all kind of notions which were right, yet they were wrong. Just a simple example, the mythology of the Greek gods or the Nordic gods. The Greek gods had Zeus being the god having the lightning in hand. And there's a lot of stories about people then meeting Zeus and say, okay, now I want to see you in the real form. And so I said, please don't ask that, just don't ask that, because you can't handle the truth. And then, of course, they say, no, I want to see you in real form. And then Zeus, of course, goes into the lightning, and they get scorched and burned and incinerated on the spot. And so Zeus is the symbolic link that at the deepest level, or at the core level of what happens in the organs, it is electrical. In the Nordic mythology, Thor is connected to that, but where Zeus is connected to the lightning, Thor is connected to the thunder. And I once had a nice scarf called Lightning Hears No Thunder. So there is a relationship between lightning and thunder, but when thunder comes, lightning has already gone. So when in the Nordic mythology they describe it as the thunder, it sort of shows that they have more clouds when the lightning takes place, so they see the thunder, perhaps they hear the thunder better than they see the lightning. And for them, the thunder came out of the big hammer bashing the anvil and the sparks coming out. So it's essentially the same principle. And in that way, there are lots of myths and mythologies giving an understanding of something which at that time could not be formulated. There was, in this transition from the notion to the concept, to the idea, to the thought, a transition from the unknown to the known, which is sort of half digested. So I'm not so in favor of trying to use terms like entities and then fill in all kind of notion on the entities as if they are real, because for me the entity is at the level of the notions. It's like a gas, and from a gas or a cloud I can expect rain, but I cannot expect something coherent. Yes, maybe ice comes out of it in the form of snow, but then it will just be a blanket of snow and not a form of understanding as yet. So I'm seeking more to see the relationship between the notions, the concept, the ideas, and the thoughts, also when they are presented in a collective sense. So there are all kind of cultures which have their basis of knowledge, and in the Western world they call that science, but you can easily see that science is mythological, science is religion, science is a cult, and science is a banking system, but the truth of science, they change from day to day and sometimes from second to second. So the notions of science of 500 years ago are different from those 203 years ago, are different from those from a year ago. And if you look at the scientific development of, say, a century ago, that's where classical science transformed into the theory of relativity, 1915, 1918. The quantum theory, 1916, 1918, 1924, thereabouts. And then field theory, which came, say, in 1950s, a bit before, a bit after, but it already existed in different mathematical forms earlier. In a way, you could say that field theory was already implied in the Lorentz and the Minkowski and Lobachev kind of mathematics of vibrations. The Helmholtz and Schrödinger research on fields and vibrational models was already the initiation of the field theory as we know now. So if we have these kind of transitions of understanding in science, where science always tries to be clear and precise and explicit in what it describes, then it should not be doubted that in other forms of cultural development, the same kind of transitions took place. So there is always the relationship between science and art and trade and mysticism. Trade is the exchange between people, the cultural communication level as well. So then you can see that from science, which tries to describe things from one perspective, and art, which tries to open new perspective by dancing around the way you can see it, and trade, which seeks to look at it from one side and the other and tries to see the benefit from it, and mysticism, who tries to see everything as a whole and understand from that perspective. Those are examples of, say, the four elements of alchemy as we see them in cultural development in humanity. That means that science is just one form of expression, art, the eye opener, has a different one, trade, the complementarity of different perspectives is yet another level, and mysticism, which insists and demonstrates that everything must be one, and everything must be essentially the same, is just another expression of it all. It still means that science, art, trade, and mysticism are all describing the same. All of them operate in the same cinema or theater of the world that we live in, and all of them are done by humans as members of humanity. And it doesn't much matter which culture you are in, they will all have their form of science, their forms of art, their forms of trade, and their forms of mysticism. And from then on, you can see that much of what happens is determined by the way people do or do not connect in how they share their ideals and their ideals. And that is essentially already the level of the entity and the id entity or the identity. Are people sharing the information that they have, and are they open to the views of others? Or are they insistent that others don't count? The Jews have this notion of the goy, the Catholics have the notion of the heathen, the Muslims have this notion of the infidel, which basically means that they're the good guys and everybody else is the bad guy. And if you look at it at a deeper level, the Muslims have the same God as the Christians, which has the same gods as the Hebrews, and all of them insist that there is only one God. So how can it be that they say that the God of the other guys is not the same God as their guys? And why do they not recognize that they all have the same notion of or concept of God, and that they therein are just brothers and sisters of the same understanding that all is connected in oneness? That's where we see that there's a level of politics and power politics which distorts the understanding. And some of the research that I'm doing now shows that this power politics is essentially based on a misunderstanding where people know that they are individuals, that as individuals they have relationships, that they can actually have relationships of relationships which they call groups, but they don't yet understand that the groups of groups is called humanity, which means that humanity or God, the sharing of knowledge of everybody, is the integrative factor, and that all of the groups within humanity are part of humanity. They're not competing against each other, they're not in opposition against each other. They complement each other, and thereby they can complete themselves and each other. At the moment there's some difficulty in that because of the money system and the political system and other things of basically playing out one group of humans against the other group of humans for the benefit of, let's say, the bankers or whoever is trying to run the show. And those people who are doing that will at some point need to die to discover that no, everybody in humanity is part of that whole body of humanity. Every human is a cell in the body of humanity. And just as you cannot have a war or a disease within a body, you cannot have that in humanity either. I need this bridge to help understand that when we are looking at different cultures having different expressions of things, of perceptions, of experiences, that we need to bypass this whole notion that there are cultural differences. No, there are differences in cultural expressions, but no difference in cultural understanding. Yes, the cultures might have different language, and they might have a different mental model, or they might have a different religious or political system, but they're all humans in the body of humanity, and we all share the same earth and the same universe. We all have essentially the same body and essentially the same universe. So all the differences that we perceive are ways by which we can understand that there is more than we can see if we just are able to look from the experience or the perception of somebody else as well. And of course it's funny or macabre, depending on how you look at it, that sex is actually the solution for learning how to resolve complementarity. The difference between the sexes, male and female, leads to the fusions of the sexes in sexual interaction and orgasm. By orgasm you can activate telepathy, as I described in another talk. And then through the telepathy you can discover that the male and the female are part of the same story, but like the left loudspeaker and the right loudspeaker in the stereo set. It's not that the loudspeakers form the music, but the loudspeakers carry the music. And what you then see as individuals, you can also see as cultures. So I needed to put that perspective in place, because once you understand that the cultures have the same perspective, but they look at it in a different way, they make a different artistic impression of what they are looking at, then you can also see that all of the myths and all of the stories and all of the fairy tales and all of the sagas of the different cultures are attempts to describe something which is very concrete and specific, to address something which is not concrete and not specific. That's where you have the specific and the general, and the intangible and the tangible together defining the playing field of what we experience. That's what the alchemist described as the four elements. Yes, we have tangible, specific things like the earth. We have tangible, non-specific things like water. We have intangible, specific things like air. And we specific intangible, non-specific things like fire. You can't touch it. Once you understand that, it is evident that all of the myths, the sagas, the stories of the different cultures are attempts to describe the unknown. And as Philip Zimbardo described it, once you try to relate to the unknown, you have to take four steps. You have to anonymize, you have to generalize, you have to abstract, and in a way you have to derealize, you have to dematerialize what you're dealing with. Because if you want to translate an experience, a tangible, concrete experience, into a general principle, you need to realize that you're no longer talking about that specific event. So you need to anonymize it. You can see that somebody else could have that same experience. You need to generalize it by realizing that that experience which took place could also take place in a different concept, or a different context, or a different environment, or between different people. So you need to not only anonymize it, but you need to also generalize it. The anonymization is about the individual, the generalization is about the relationship. And then the third step is that of the abstraction. You have to get it out of context. You need to realize that in a different context it can have a different form. The tree standing in the forest can have a different shape than a tree standing by the breeze of the ocean. Or a different shape as a tree, which finds it very difficult to find food to grow on. So the abstraction is to take it away from its context and realize that it could take place somewhere else as well. And then the fourth step is that you are aware that you are replacing that what you are looking at by something symbolic. You take it out of the reality of the physical into the reality of the descriptions, and thereby you disconnect the thing from the thingness and turn it into an idea, a thought, a nothingness. So the thing you can touch, the idea you cannot touch. But the idea we can very quickly communicate, and the thought, the object, the thing, that's just very specific. Just to think of the example, my friend Tino mentioned that at some point, that if you have an apple and the other one has a pear and you trade, then you have the pear and the other one has the apple. But if you have an idea and the other has an idea and you trade, then you have two ideas and the other has two ideas. So they are different realities. And so this reality of myths and sagas and other things, which are no things, are attempts to deal with the ungraspable. There are many attempts to describe something in words, but there are no words for it. Of course, the main progress of science is that every time somebody discovers something new, a new word is made. And if you look at the amount of words that are in existence today compared to what was available 100 years ago to what was used 1,000 years ago, you can see that there's a tremendous amount of new words. The Pope, in trying to describe the cigarette, had to use the Latin word baticula nicotinica, a little nicotine stick, because the word was not there when the Romans were around. So the Latin did not have that concept, didn't have a word for it. In that same way, there are lots of ideas for which we don't have words, or no words as yet. And that, of course, makes it difficult to then describe things, because in order to be able to describe it, you need to do the inverse of this dynamic of anonymization, generalization, abstraction, and derealization. You need to actually create a new word, define a very specific, non-specific environment that it can take place in, and then be very clear on what kind of relationship it applies to and which one's not. And then you can understand what kind of things it could refer to or not. And mathematics is one of the languages which is able to sort that out quite neatly. That's also why mathematics is the lingua franca, the connecting language in all kinds of science, because it is that tool for thought, for those specific differences in levels of thought. And so in the past, when you try to describe the nature of, for example, plants in a specific environment, and how the plants would grow in specific seasons, but you don't know about plant nutrients, your understanding of microbes and the way microbes interact with the fungus on the roots of plants is very scant or not present at all. Then how can you describe the nature of the plant, which is connected to the microbes in the soil, which is connected to the fungus on the roots, which is connected to everything else in the environment around it, the kind of minerals that the soil is composed of? Especially if you're in shepherd land, where you have some sheep and some flowers and some trees, and that is basically the language that you can work with. At some point I was talking with somebody who said in the Massif Central in France, people get around with 600 words, but if you need to use 600 words for everything, that's the Strumpf kind of language, that's that cartoon of the Smurfs, where they use the word Smurfs for everything that they want to describe but don't have the word for, then you need to Smurf your language at many different levels. And the French word was Strumpf. So you need to Strumpf up your language in trying to describe the plant in relationship to the microbe, in relationship to the fungus, in relationship to the atomic structure of the minerals and the elements in the soil. But you don't know about the atomics, and you don't know about the fungus, and you don't know about the microbes, so you need to strumpf a lot in your language. So how can you then describe the specific differences in the characteristics or the qualities of a plant? Well, you can do the standard trick that you describe them by association, just like the word thunder mimics the sound of the thunder. There are words that mimic sounds, or that mimic shapes, or that mimic relationships. And then you can sort of connect one word to the other word to show that you're actually doing a kind of word mathematics of having a value of a word replaced by a variable which you actually want to understand as an operator, and as you would call it in mathematics, so that you can see what equation you're really addressing. What I just described is the core element of meta-mathematics, that in the values we can describe the things that are concrete, in the variables we can describe the things which are not concrete as yet. In the operators, we can describe that we are actually just looking at the relationships involved, which is also the relationship to ourselves, of course. And then in the equation sign, we essentially want to formulate how we are in that picture, yes or no. So in metamathematics, there's a possibility to be much more specific on how we can define and use language, but if you're in shepherd land of 100 or 1,000 years ago, how do you do it then? How do you want to say that this plant will bite you and that plant will actually soothe you? So can you associate it with something that is bitey or something that is soothy or something that is practical? And then you already get a kind of language of devils and angels. The devils are the things that are not helping us, the angels are the things that are good for us. Actually, the word devil comes from evil, and evil is when you turn the word live backwards. So that what is backwards or reverses the process of life within us is evil, and the evil becomes devil. It's that simple. An angel from angelos or angelic messenger is basically a signal that it will work for you. So that's a kind of binary code of things which are good or bad for you. And then, of course, if you think that through, there will be the same kind of hierarchy of angels as there is a hierarchy of devils, if you want to believe in hierarchies. If you want to look at it differently, you can say that there are all kind of characteristics of those plants, or by extension also for animals, which are unlikable or likable, and then you can relate it to the four elements. So you can have the dwarfs and the elves as something which has to do with the earth, or something that has to do with the pollination. Are you dealing with the root of the thing, or are you dealing with the flower of the thing? When you're dealing with the flower of the thing, and the flower opens up and it sort of looks like the butterfly. When the flowers are open, the butterflies are there. Flutter by butterfly, call it an elf. And you already have this whole notion of pollination, summer, the openness of the plants, the interaction of the seed and the sperm of the plants, pollination in general. It's the level of the communication in life. But you can't see it. So the elves are there, but you can't see them. In the same way, there are the dwarfs, which are something that has to do with the seeds and the roots and the soil and the underground part of the story. Once you understand that people are trying to look for words to describe something for which they don't have words as yet, then you can try to fathom what is it that they try to address. And evidently you have to do a kind of reverse engineering, because when you see all kind of stories about the neat elves and how everything communicates, or the dwarfs and all the hard work and the labor, are you still realizing that it is a story about summer versus winter, about the flowers versus the seed, about the openness versus the closeness, about that what is transforming all the time, or that is what has become rigid? Or are these stories leading their own lives and you no longer connected to why they were there? So then, yes, there are lots of stories about elves and fairies and dwarfs, and the Lord of the Rings is an example of that, where the properties of openness and closeness, connectedness and disconnectedness, identity or it entity or entity, are played out via those kind of metaphors. But you can also all reduce it to this notion of what is the relationship between the identity, which is you, and the entity or the it entity. Call the entity the angel, or the it entity the devil. When you are not connected to it, how does it work for you? And when you realize that we're talking about relationship in the things that we see in the world around us, but we're actually referring to our experience of it, then you can turn the whole thing around and say, well, these elves and dwarfs and dragons and whatnots are expression of something out there, but essentially they are processes taking place in our mind. So let's find in our mind what's going on and look in our mind what we're dealing with. And then essentially it all reduces to one simple thing, that you have a new experience, and either you can fit it in into what you know already and you can get it to work and you can make good use of it, or you cannot fit it in, you cannot get it to work, and you cannot make use of it. The things that you can make use of it, you'll call beneficial. The things you cannot make use of it, you'll call diabolical or untoward or bad or whatever you want to call it. But the problem is not in the thing that exists. The problem lies in your lack of knowing how to work with it. If you understood the fire, then when the fire struck you down as a caveman, you might be horrified, but at the moment that you master fire, a couple of thousand years later, and you can heat your home by harnessing the fire. So we have things that we do not know, and we convert them, we digest them into things that we do know. We have things that we cannot relate to, and we find instruments and means to relate to it. And humans are very specific in having two techniques, they're called language and technology, by which we can relate to things in a very elaborate way. By language, we can relate to each other, we can help each other, and we can use each other's, pick each other's mind for more solutions. And as soon as anyone has a solution, everyone can have the solution. It's the kind of godly heaven on earth kind of principle of telepathic sharing of information. Now everybody knows, everyone knows how to deal with it. Technology is the way we can work with it. So language is the part of the understanding, say the mind part of the story, and technology is the body part of the story. With technology we get a new fork, or we get a new knife, or we get a new handle, or whatever we try to deal with, and as a result of which we can do things. Invent the scuba diving gear and you can go underwater. Invent the submarine and you can go underwater much deeper, much longer. That's a matter of understanding how we relate to the world around us by making available the knowledge that we already have and extend it and expand it by new knowledge. So we are always dealing with this process of learning new things, connecting up to old things, and in that process we do have to get rid of misunderstandings. Science now has a different model of reality than was used 100 years ago. And medicine now has a different approach to a body than was used 100 or 500 years ago. I would be inclined to say that the model that medicine uses now is different, but not necessarily better. Yes, a lot of people are more healthy, and a lot of more people can be saved from death, if you want to call it that. But there are also a lot of iatrogenic diseases, and there is also a lot of distortion of the environment by the misunderstanding of how our body really works. In the past, there was, in that sense, a more integrated understanding of how people are part of the universe. So we can see that theories can change and models can change. Theories, language, The model is the technology. So theory and technology are the two parts that we work with. But we also see that in the understanding of all new knowledge and all new experience, all new insights that we have. So we use the language and the technology to improve our understanding of the environment. And in doing so, we will need to incorporate the unknown in the known. And actually, it requires different mindset. And that's why we then need to go from the outside world to the inside world, because we need to realize that when we use tools and language between us, they're actually the counterpart of the psychology and the physiology within us. So in everything I do in science of life, I bring it back to that common denominator. We all have a body. We all have a very similar body. We all have a body based on exactly the same universal principles. So let's understand everything in terms of what happens in the body. And then suddenly you can see that the known and the unknown is part of the mind. And in the previous story, I addressed part of that. More to come. But more specifically, what we're dealing with in entities and identities and it entities is the relationship between the physiology and the psychology. And as I've mentioned in the other story already, that when there is a life shock, the physiology and the psychology can become disconnected. You do a bit the same as in an out-of-body experience. The mind and the body disconnect, but as a result, it can be that the mind suddenly needs to start a new kind of experience or a new kind of understanding, and it's not always possible to connect that to the previous understanding. You see that process a lot in science. Somebody else starts a new kind of mathematics, and it takes a long time before other people understand that you can actually do something with it. And it takes much longer before it is understood that you can then thereby understand the relationship between other forms of mathematics and different forms of science much better. In the mind, we have that capacity that you can go to a different country. You don't need to know the language. You don't need to know the customs. You don't need. It is as if you're reborn in that other country. And so the Christians and the born-again Christians and the born-again and again and again Buddhist, they understand that you are free to go into a different environment and go back to the capacity of learning of the baby and make sense of it. You don't have to translate what you learned to what you already knew, might help, but you can actually interpret directly from what you see to how your body and mind can deal with it. But part of that might require that you use a part of mind which is new specifically for that purpose. Just as when you learn a new language, it goes into your brain, but it is as if you add a new software program in a computer. It does not make use of your calculation program, it doesn't make use of the drawing program, it makes use of the language program. But it is not slotted with the other languages because it doesn't compute in that language format. It's like a one computer language versus another computer language in a computer. You have them separate. Once you go into that process of learning that other language and that other culture, you create a new reality for yourself. You create a new identity for yourself in that form of existence. That's where you can then see that you have an identity, and everybody who has traveled between countries and moved between countries and lived longer in other countries knows that, that you have a different identity in one culture or another or another or another. At one of the conferences where I was, we talked about that, and there was this woman from Japan who said that the Makiko in Japan was different from the Makiko in Europe. In Europe, she had a totally different freedom to be herself and express herself, because the cultural constraints which they have in Japan, they don't use in Europe. And in that sense, people will have different, let's say, characters, let's better call it identities, within them. And everybody knows that. You have different friends, but with each of your friend, another part of you is expressed. So in that sense, every relationship opens up or addresses a different part of your identity. It could even be that if you have been in different cultures, that you have an identity in one culture and another identity in the other, and yet you can choose from which of those identities you will connect to the new person that you have just met. It does mean that internally you are divided. And that is also the difference between the identity, the entity, and the id entity. The id is a term which comes from the Freudian model of mind, which is an incomplete model, by the way. So he said there is the superego, there is the ego, and there is the id. And the superego in that terminology would be the mindset of the people around you, the common cultural denominator. At that time it was the church or the belief system that people lived in, that dominated their society. The ego is how you define yourself within your own life, in the relationship that you have, in the conditions that you live in. And the id is that part of you which has been repressed because you cannot express that in that environment. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who described it as the superego is the policeman, but also the internalized policeman, and the id is the internalized desperado. Because if your ego or yourself or your I cannot express all of you because there is this inbuilt policeman, then there is a part of you which is not allowed to be you, the internal desperado. And that internal desperado in Freudian terminology is called the id. It is also compared to an animal, it's also compared to being scared, it's also compared to being isolated, also compared to being dark. So depending on the terminology, you would see that the superego, which would then be called enlightened, and the id, which would be called darker part of you, they're simply the part of you which you acknowledge, put in the light, or the part that you deny, but keep in the dark. There's a lot of corrections which need to be put on that model, because, for example, the ego, when you look at it closer, it's like the skin of the soul. It's a structure of dead cells covering your body, but in that case of the ego, it is the reflex structure of things that you've thought before, which you use as a kind of shield for dealing with the environment around you, same as you have the skin in the body. And let me go back to this understanding of the entity and the id entity. So the id entity is connected to that repressed part of you, or repressed part of other. The id entity is the denied part, and the identity is where the denied part is integrated with your being. You know that there's part of you which you cannot express, but you don't have a difficulty with that, because you know that you're not like a plant that you're fixed in one spot. You're like an animal, you can go from one territory to the other. If there are people that you can not talk about some things, you can find people where you can't talk about that with them. And if you cannot talk, find other people, you can in any case have an internal communication with yourself about that. So with yourself, you can still explore and express that part of you which others would not like to see. But by addressing it and getting to know it, you can integrate it within your own being. And that essentially is the whole part of this story about the myths and the saga, the entities and the identities, that we all have experience where we sort of get shocked out of our wits, that we suddenly discover that we have to do everything in a different manner. For me, it happened when I moved from the Netherlands to the United States, and I discovered that they all spoke a different language, and I had to change into that, and overnight that happened. So where first I was in sort of in a pressure zone with this awkward and odd and strange English language, the day after my mind had switched to English, and I also realized later that that process of the switch of mind was like an airplane going through the barrier of sound. So I now know that we have a barrier of consciousness, or call it the limitation of the ego, the limitation of the known and the reflexes. And once you go through that, suddenly this other world opens up. And then you essentially have two approaches. You have the people who find themselves in that new reality, and then later discover how they can integrate it to that knowledge that they had, or they cannot. And that is the essence of the principle of healing of a life shock. If people have a life shock, then the body and the soul in a way disconnect. So the body mind and the soul mind disconnect, as I described in the story of Mining Mind. And if that rift is not repaired, then those two parts will not be able to integrate. So when new experiences take place, the one part, say the body-related part or the mind-related part, they have different responses to it and they cannot integrate it. And the charge that builds up between them is called the emotions. These things can also happen in the mind, so you can have fragments of mind. And those fragments of mind will respond to the information around by their own characteristics, by their own bit of information that they were based on. And that's where you can then speak of multiple personalities or multiple personality disorders, that in these people there are fragments of mind who will all respond to the events going on, but depending on say which part of the broken mirror they are, the response will be more limited or more pronounced, or it will be stronger or it will be weaker, and there will be interaction between them. So in the broken mind there will be emotions, where in the healed mind there will be feelings, and in the broken mind different parts of the mind can respond to what happens, and people can experience it as if they have different reaction to what goes on. If they don't understand what's going on, then they cannot well navigate it. For example, in me, I have a Dutch protocol and I have an English protocol. Makiko had a Japanese protocol and a European protocol. In a new country, which of the two would you use, or would you create a new one? And that is the whole navigation of the newness, of learning, of extending your understanding. Are you able to build up on that part of you which already has learned things in a different context and keep on using that in the other context? Or will you suddenly discover that in that other context you cannot do that? People who come from the West and go to the Arabic countries suddenly realize that the way male and female, or rich and poor, relate to each other are different than in Europe. And those are the kind of protocols which will make it difficult for a cultural conditioned response or identity from one culture to go to the other. And if you're fixed to your identity, if you believe that the way you do things is the way to do things, that's the wife of Lot kind of story, that you be fossilized in your reflex behavior, your ego system determining your life, then your soul and your mind cannot help you to see that you can do it differently. You cannot use beginner's mind, as it is called in Zen and in the I Ching. You cannot go back to basics of how did you do that as a baby. Can you simply be there and accept that that's how they do it, learn from it, and learn to do it too? Or do you think that the knowledge that you already have, which you build up into knowledge and into the reflex structure you call the ego, and you think that that should be able to handle it? Well, most often you'll discover that the ego structure crashes, and if you don't reboot your baby capacities, you will not be able to address that culture shock. The word culture shock actually describes that. It's that transition of the barrier of mind, like the sonic boom that you go to and transition from one side of the other in understanding. So in our mind, you can have this situation where fragments of the mind occur. Life sucks can do that. Some nasty people actually intentionally do that and cripple the mind of people by doing so. So there is a lot of understanding and knowledge of that happens and how it happens and how different parts of the mind can in a way have their own lives or represent different kind of characteristics in somebody. So you could say that they have different entities within them, and if they switch from one entity to the other, you could say that they are possessed. But I don't think that that helps to leave it at that kind of terminology. Yes, there are people who are out of their comfort zone or out of the environment that they know. They don't know how to do it differently, so they fall back on the behavior that they have had. It doesn't work. In fact, it cripples them, which is essentially the story of the wife of Lot in the Bible. She lives in her little village. She's very happy. She goes out of the village, and in the gate, there's the part that she still knows and the other part that she doesn't know, but she still feels comfortable because there's still that part that she knows. And then she's outside of the village and then can look back on it. She can still understand it, and she still knows what to do because it connects to the village. And then she crosses over the hill, and she has no reference what to do, so she doesn't know what to do, so she does nothing, because she can no longer connect to her internal frame of reference. So people do have that kind of thing, and some people actually flip from one experiential set to another, so they behave differently. Say the Japanese behavior in Europe would not be understood here, so somebody falling back on Japanese behavior would not integrate well. Me with my Dutch behavior in America, later in Canada, later in England, that wouldn't work. People expect a kind of behavior that they have, and if you can't do, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, if you can assimilate them that way, and if you can adapt in that way, then you can extend your identity. You grow in the different ways that you can be, and you accept it, and the mind just opens like a flower with more and more petals of what you can do, and it's all connected. If it is no longer connected, the flower petals fall apart, there's no integrating factor anymore, then one part of mind will kick in, and then another kick in, and the circumstances will determine what happens instead of your soul. There's no integrated factor, no stem to the flower anymore, and all the petals fall apart. Once you understand that, you can look at the stem of the flower and say, well, that is where your pivot is, your soul, is that you can live in all these kind of settings. Now connect to your soul instead of the kind of behavior patterns that other people expect. Create a new one. And then people can have new petals grow from the stem of their soul flower. And as a result, they can then integrate those different experiences. So people with a fragmented mind often lost contact with their soul. When they're reconnected to their soul, and that's a story in itself, everything falls in place. And I know somebody who actually realized that this is how it happened. So he went to a deeper level of his own being and said, well, all of the behavior that I have is basically contextual, circumstantial, and a sort of haphazard collage of events. In the tarot cards, it is the patchwork kilt of the fool. So this friend went to his inside bed and said, well, okay, now I'm just going to let it dissolve, all of it, and I'm going to let it fall in place without my conditioning it. So he withdrew all of his belief programs on the reflex system, and he suspended all of the decisions that were connected to it. And as a result, he went into a deep trance, and all of the knowledge that he had dissolved. It's a bit like the cells in cell division process. And it took him a week to first learn to be, then to piss and shit, and then to sit on and get up, and then to walk, and then to talk. And then after a week, everything came back. But the bias of the different conditional sets was gone. Everything was integrated. So this is just one example of one technique by which a disintegrated mind, and in his case, the mind was compartmentalized, not disintegrated. But the principle is the same. It can be integrated again. So at that point, the entities which were active in somebody, let's call it that, are parts of the mind which respond to different triggers in the environment, and sometimes they just fall apart. In that case, it is necessary to realize that you are dealing with parts of the whole, and to reconnect to the whole by knowing that the parts are not what it is about, that the parts themselves are insufficient, they're incomplete, and that there is something else which makes the completion. That's essentially what they try to do in the Alcoholics Anonymous and in the religions, that there's a larger power than you. In this case, instead of the fragments of the mind, there is also the soul that connects everything. And once you acknowledge that, then it's no longer the souls who try, the mind parts which try to identify themselves for you or instead of you, which is essentially a diabolical process, but it becomes an evangelical process or an angelical process. It's different terminology for the same concept, that you are again the expression of your soul. So let me sort of try to bring it together in an integrated notion. Entities and identities are essentially the same concept. In entities, they're separated. In identities, they're integrated. In identities, separate from you as identity, you identify yourself with it. It makes a difference in if you're outside of the ship or inside of the ship. Do you have the helm of the ship in your hand, your identity? If you don't have the helm in your hand, then you're an it entity. The things do not connect. Entities will have their own characteristics, just as identities do. Identities will have an integrated steering because they have the helm and they're connected to the soul. Entities appear not to have that. So the way to understand the entities is that, yes, there are fragments of information processes. They're like part of a computer program, like the subroutines of a computer program. And what is necessary is that they are connected up. Sometimes you need to stop the computer, or you need to stop the program, or you need to suspend the corresponding belief, which is also connected to the conditions of that environment. So you need to, in a way, isolate it in a kind of laboratory setting and realize that whatever is going on is real from the perspective of that part of mind, but it is not real from the perspective to the other parts of mind. It is as an internal disease in a body, part of the body is doing something else than the rest of it. It's no longer integrated. How can you integrate it again? So use the homeopathy, use the acupuncture. The homeopathy is to inform the whole body of what's going on. The acupuncture is to reconnect the bits to the whole. Because essentially it's always the same principle that a part is a part. So I like the word game. So a part, separate, and a part connected, it's the same principle. But do you realize that a part is a part? Yes or no? Is a part a part, separate, or is a part, separate, a part, connected? That's the game that we play. That's the equation sign that we are. That's the act of creator in creation. And sometimes you need to do that on fragments of the mind. And fragments of the mind, they are always associated with the reflex pattern behavior. Because fragments of the mind, they represent a conviction or a belief. And the parts of the mind, or the convictions, the beliefs, are always based on a decision. So if you want to heal the split mind, you need to go back to the decision, that event, that experience where the mind was split. And like the out-of-body experience, you need to come back into your body, you need to reconnect by realizing that you have a choice to reconnect in a different way. And that you can actually change the context in which that what you believe is valid. You can suspend the belief, or you can say, well, I no longer am interested in that belief, or actually now I want to see the other side of that belief. That's the whole art of being a creator in creation, that we can change our decisions and thereby can renew our choices. So in the body, in the mind, we can see that from our choice we can create a decision, we can cultivate a belief, a conviction, and out of that, by our behavior, we will create a conduct or a reflex behavior. So the conduct is based on the conviction. A lot of people have become convicts of their own convictions. Again, one of those nice word games. And once you realize that entities are most often convictions, and they could be yours, or they could be telepathically connected to somebody else, or they could be memories from another time zone, or ancestral memory popping up from the DNA, it doesn't much matter. There are moments when there are convictions or beliefs popping up in the mind, and the only question is, how do you deal with them? When you have strange ideas come by, do you jump on it and ride them out to the bitter end or the happy end, or do you realize when that train is going into the direction where you don't want to be? So then you step on the train of thought and you get rid of that conviction, as you would do in any kind of meditation. If you don't want to hang on to the thought, you just let go of it. And then the entity, which the character of that thought, or the belief that you have stepped into at that moment, is no longer the vehicle that you're surfing. So you step off that wave and get the surfboard somewhere else, and then that wave, which is going to crash into the rocks further down, is no longer the vehicle, so you will not crash into the rocks further down. So the working with entities is very much about understanding what convictions are, beliefs. It is very much tied into the notion that once you step into a conviction that really feels and seems real to you, and when you act on it, you create conduct. When you decide that this reality is not for you, it's as if you put on the virtual reality goggles and decide, well, no, I'm not interested in the movie. You take them off. Just like you watch the television and you don't like the program, you change the channels. In your mind, too, if you have a belief system, a conviction that you don't like, you just step out of it. You turn your surfboard the other way, you step off the wave, and say, well, I can do another belief as well. I don't have to do this belief. And you just step off the wave, and you're in the lull between the waves, and then you can swim every direction you want to go. once you realize that, then you have the power of decision back, and this entity or this belief or this conditioned conviction no longer has a hold over you, because you have a hold over it. You can choose. But you do need to realize that reflexes are three-dimensional, convictions are two-dimensional, decisions are one-dimensional, and choice is zero-dimensional. You're actually navigating between different dimensions. It's like different gears in the gearbox. The hormones are different. The dopamine, the acetylcholine, the GABA, and the serotonin, they're different gears. So you actually need to shift between them. And the most difficult thing that many people have is that they believe their reality is real, and it's not. The reality that you're in, if you cross a border, you're in a different reality. If you cross a time zone, you're in a different reality. If you cross a belief, you're a different reality. So we all have event horizons as they are described in the theory of relativity. But the thickness of the event horizon, which is also the barrier of consciousness, is only one quantum leap. The quantum leap is the decision that you take. Are you going to take the decision yes or no? Then when you do the quantum leap in a quantum field, in the quantum theory, then you have changed the time scope or the belief that you're in the relativistic theory. Of course, if you don't know that, your classical theory, and you believe that things are as they are and they will be forever. But that's where classical theory, looking at matter, fell apart. It was realized that no, matter is molecular, and that's where the theory of relativity with the event horizon is operative. It is a process, just like our convictions, just like our beliefs. And then once you look deeper, you see it's atomic, and the quantum leap actually determines if it goes one way or the other way, if it connects or disconnect. And so that's what we do with our decisions. And once you're there, you can understand that all is based on the quantum field, as described in tetrionics, and that's where actually things are all connected. So when people are, let's say, possessed by different entities, those are beliefs which were conditioned at some point and which have been triggered by some conditioning reflex trigger, and as a result they're operative. But if you realize that that's just a circulatory mental process in your mind, and that you have other mental processes in your mind, as you learn with meditation, then you can just say, I hop off this ice sheet, and either I hop onto another iceberg, or I'm going to swim in the water. Yeah, maybe it feels cold at the beginning, but at some point you find that you're in the tropics. So once you learn to switch from the conditioned beliefs of the entities and go into that capacity to switch between beliefs, where you can actually swim from one state to the other, the quantum leaps, then you discover that you can navigate that much better. And that's also why in that talk on mending mind, I juxtaposed these two perspectives, the psychosomatic principle, where mind and body are connected because they're both aspects of cell communication. But the other side of that is the out-of-body experience, where you can have the body asleep, mind awake, and you can separate mind from body. And in that sense, you can also separate soul from mind and have the mind be healed by soul. And that's the story in itself. A soul is a different dimension. And so when people have different parts of mind, fragments of mind, entities, then you can heal them. Coming back to where the story started, once you understand that you can do that in your mind, then evidently you can also do that between cultures. And once you understand that all the myths and the saga and the fairy tales and all the stories in the different cultures are expressions of things which are not yet fully understood, then you can look at those from a different perspective and try to understand what is it that these people were addressing, what was the circumstance that they were in, what was the aim that they had at that time, and what are the words that we have for that now. And in that way, I was in the British Library and I read a lot of these myths and mythologies, sagas and tales from the different cultures. I could compare that with the physics and the mathematics, and I realized that all of them were operating the same logic. And so for me it was evident that even though they were having different metaphors to describe that they were trying to describe, for which they didn't have words yet, they all were dealing with the same understanding and trying to connect it to their same body. We all have the same body, we have the same universe that we live in, so all the differences in perspectives are just because we are standing from a different standpoint and thereby can complement each other. And that complementarity of standpoints also applies for the complementarity of different, say, fragments of the mind. And once you understand that, the pieces of the puzzle of the mind can come together and together show the larger picture where it is unfragmented. And that's why I'm describing that story of minding mind for mending mind. And that's why this part of the story of entities and id entities and identities basically addresses the techniques or the technicalities of having the pieces of the puzzle fit themselves together again so that you no longer are stuck to the different bits of belief, the different bits of convictions, but that you can realize that with the slight change of circumstances, you would have the opposite belief, you would have the opposite conviction. So why would you need to have a difficulty with somebody else facing you who has precisely that opposite conviction or that opposite belief? It's just looking at it from the other side of the equation. And as I said before, if you put something from one side of the equation sign to the other, the plus becomes a minus or the minus becomes a plus. And so if you have two different perspectives, like the male and the female, then together suddenly there is something which is no longer male, no longer female, but becomes human and is able to reproduce human. So you can only have that when the duality of the complementarity is resolved. And when you realize that the opposites are actually in essence the same, and by that same principle of dissolving the boundary, the perceived boundary, then likewise the fragments of the mind can be dissolved or resolved as well, and you can integrate mind. And that is also founded on the principle of the science of life, that in the universe, which is a field of vibration, it is all about do you create or dissolve a boundary? Do you see unity or do you see duality? But that boundary, if you zoom in on it, it turns out to be a field. If you zoom out on a field, it will turn out to be a boundary. So the boundary and the field is essentially the same, which means that a boundary is a field, and either you go through the boundary and you go from the one side to the other side, so you face invert, you go through the boundary by turning into the opposite, and then everything just simply goes on, which is, by the way, neatly exemplified by the Tiller-Einstein equation. Bill Tiller realized that where Einstein said, well, when you go into the speed of light, into the barrier of light, you have to invest all of this energy and you never get there. But if you account for the width of the barrier of light being one quantum, then you can get there. And by quantum theory, you can get the the energy to go into that barrier of light. The whole of nature shows it. But Bill Tiller also showed that once you do that quantum leap at the barrier of light, and when you turn into the phase opposite, because that's what a quantum change is, at the other side of the boundary, all of the energy that you invested into it comes back. So that is the mechanism at the core level of the boundary transition, and I call it the I-God principle, the integrate, generate, operate, and destroy a boundary. It's all about turning a boundary around, yes or no. Turning a boundary into the field, turning a field into the boundary, crossing the boundary, yes or no. That's where we operate the freedom of choice. Freedom of choice is the flip of the quantum. So once you understand that, then different parts of the mind can be integrated, but that means that different entities can find their way back home. As I discovered in therapeutic sessions, whenever I had to do with people being obsessed by entities, it turned out that there was a part of the mind which felt totally out of place. And in a way, I didn't know then, but I did a kind of out-of-body session with them so that they could disconnect that part of mind from their experience of the body in that place. And by putting them apart long enough and far enough, that part of the mind could find where it came from and what it was looking for and reconnect to that. And then the body could reconnect to the state that it was actually in. So that was like an out-of-body experience with a twist, a quantum twist, a freedom of choice. And then the entity could go back to where it wanted to be, and the wholeness of the mind, which was always there on the background, could fit back into place. So let me just leave it with that, because that's essentially the technique which I used and found worked, and now I can actually describe it, so that's quite funny.